in this tension with these other nuclear armed superpowers?
You know, it may be, and there's not a lot of detail in what President Trump said, it may be in response to what the Russians announced last week on a further enhancement of their nuclear weapons program. And it may be that President Trump is trying to get the attention of the Russians and the Chinese, that if they go off and begin to violate international agreements, the United States can do that too. That's an educated guess on my part. I found it certainly was not coincidental that this announcement was made 1 hour before President Trump and President Xi sat down. You know, both sides try to have leverage over the other, and it must have been an intentional announcement designed to get the attention of the Chinese leadership as well as the Russians.
That's Nicholas Burns, who served as U.S. ambassador to China during the Biden administration. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Layla.
In Gaza, a surge in aid has failed to materialize. That's despite promises by Israel in a ceasefire clinched 3 weeks ago. And Israel is now banning some of the world's biggest aid groups that have worked in Gaza for decades. NPR's Jane Arraf has more.
Save the Children has operated in Gaza for more than 70 years. This week, it said it had been informed by Israel's Ministry for Diaspora Affairs and Combating Anti-Semitism that it did not meet the new criteria for re-registration and would need to pull out its international staff. Israel's new rules require personal details of staff and their families, rejected by most organizations as a security risk. The second issue, and the reason why the Ministry for Combating Anti-Semitism is involved, is that the new rules allow Israel to ban aid groups even for statements they make. At least 20,000 children have been killed in this war, most of them in Israeli airstrikes, according to Gaza health authorities. That's 2% of all of Gaza's children. An important part of Save the Children's mandate is advocating for children. It has called for the killing to stop and noted that the International Court of Justice is considering genocide charges against Israel. Israel says it does not target children. Other big players are in limbo. The Norwegian Refugee Council applied months ago to re-register, but hasn't heard anything. This is communications manager Ivan Karkashan.
We consider that the current process relies on political criteria unrelated to humanitarian conduct, and that should never really be applied to impartial aid organizations.
Gaza is essentially destroyed. International organizations see these new rules not just as denying desperately needed help, but as a warning by Israel to aid groups not to be too outspoken. Jane Arraf, NPR News, Amman.
This is NPR News.
All right, from the Middle East to the Southwest, it's Morning Edition here on KJZZ, starting off on this Thursday morning. Ahead, Americans are spending more than ever on their cars.
Overall inflation since the pandemic is up about 25%, but the cost of car ownership is up over 40%.
I have a closer look at what we all pay for our cars, the obvious costs and the often overlooked ones. That's ahead in 15 minutes at 6:35 here on KJZZ's Morning Edition.
KJZZ is supported by the Children's Museum of Phoenix, presenting Trick or Treat at the Museum, with activities and trick or treating through the museum on October 31st. Childrensmuseumofphoenix.org.
Update on a couple of early morning traffic situations near the stack I-17. A crash now on the right shoulder had been blocking a lane. Also near the mini stack along the Loop 202 westbound near 24th Street, there was a lane blockage there. That crash is now on the right shoulder as well. Well, with nearly all votes counted in the Dutch general election, the centrist D66 and Geert Wilders' far-right Freedom Party are neck and neck, each projected to win 26 seats. The result marks a sharp fall for the far-right party compared to the last election. The BBC's Anna Holligan reports.
Rob Jetten of D66 is a young, clean-cut, charismatic leader, a pragmatist, a liberal who champions inclusiveness and rejects aggressive tribalism, while Geert Wilders, veteran leader of the hard-right Freedom Party, has built his reputation as a maverick, a populist known for his provocative rhetoric against Islam and the EU. The fact the vote at the top is split between these two strikingly different leaders reflects how polarized Dutch society has become and how people across the political spectrum are craving some form of change.
That's the BBC's Anna Holligan reporting. 90, the forecast high today in Phoenix, staying a few degrees above normal. It's 66 right now.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Progressive Insurance, home of the Name Your Price tool, so drivers can see coverage options. At progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Price and coverage match limited by state law. From Fidelity Investments, a dedicated advisor can help build a comprehensive wealth plan. Learn more at fidelity.com/wealth. Investment minimums apply. Fidelity Brokerage Services, LLC. From Luminescence Foundation. Luminescence Foundation is dedicated to shedding light on neurological research focused on Alzheimer's and Parkinson's diseases and supporting land conservation initiatives. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Leila Faldin. Good morning. As part of NPR's Population Shift series, we've been spending this week looking at how families make decisions about if and when to have children. Decisions made possible in part because of hormonal birth control. Now, there's a growing social media trend that shows women quitting their hormonal birth control, even though they're not ready to become parents. Doctors are worried that some women are making decisions based on inaccurate medical information they see online. Lexi Shapiro reports on how TikTok and Instagram have become the new WebMD for family planning.
Charlotte Freed first got a hormonal IUD as a teenager. She wasn't sexually active at the time, but she wanted to be protected from pregnancy before she started college. This was also a time when she experienced anxiety, depression, and fatigue. But it wasn't until years later, when a friend of hers quit her birth control and recommended a book on the topic, that Freed started wondering if these things could be connected.
It was really upsetting and almost like a little disturbing that no doctor had ever brought it up. And honestly, I was like, I kind of just want to like meet myself in a way that I hadn't since I was, you know, 16, 17.
So Freed took out her IUD. Social media is full of stories about women like Freed quitting or questioning hormonal birth control, but not because they want to get pregnant. Some are concerned about effects on their mood and mental health. Others say doctors dismiss their complaints about weight gain, nausea, and decreased sex drive. But doctors and researchers say misleading and inaccurate claims about birth control, which decades of research has shown to be safe and effective, abound on social platforms. And they worry those claims are turning some women off the medication and could lead to unintended pregnancies.
It's important to kind of look at the difference between disinformation and misinformation.
Francesca Hedanik is an OBGYN who uses social media to educate her followers about different birth control methods.
I think it's totally appropriate that people share their negative experiences with any sort of surgery, medication, whatever. What's not okay is when it's like done purposely, and that's when we get into the disinformation.
A 2024 study analyzed posts about birth control on TikTok and found that nearly half of the posts on the topic were discouraging women from using it. Stats like that motivated Jennifer Lincoln, an OBGYN based in Portland, Oregon, to start debunking false claims on Instagram. Claims like,
that birth control is bad for you, it gives you infertility, it causes cancer, it makes you not attracted to your partner, it causes abortions. You name it, somebody on social media has said it.
And Lincoln worries that young people are using social media like a search engine for medical advice.
And it might be somebody who says it, who has a blue check mark, who even has doctor in their name, but they might not be a medical doctor. And they're selling you something, or you know, they're promising you something that has made up for the gap in the healthcare system.
I feel like women haven't been given true informed consent when it comes to the hormonal birth control pill.
That's conservative podcast host Alex Clark. She argues birth control is overprescribed and used as a band-aid that can mask more serious underlying issues. Clark took the pill for nearly 10 years before stopping. Now, she steers her listeners toward options like condoms and cycle tracking, which do not contain hormones and have much higher failure rates.
I think that if women were told the truth about hormonal birth control in general, that they would choose other options. I think just the more educated women become on it, that they're just going to say, yeah, nah, I'm good. I think they're just going to choose something else.
Dr. Jennifer Lincoln believes her colleagues should do more to explain the facts around birth control. She says social media is filling a vacuum that gets created when doctors rush their patients through appointments or brush off concerns about symptoms.
The medical field owns so much of why people are going to these forums and Reddit and TikTok for information and are really buying it because we have failed them.
When Charlotte Freed took out her IUD, she did notice improvements in her mood. She had more energy, she felt more connected to her body, and she got reacquainted with her cycle.
Then she was going abroad for graduate school, and her calculation changed.
Either the trade-off is like the possibility of having a child when you don't want to, the possibility of like hormones kind of messing up your personality or increasing anxiety, depression, fatigue, whatever. So it's a lose-lose situation.
She decided she couldn't take the risk of getting pregnant in a foreign country. Ultimately, Fried got a new IUD, for now. Lexi Schapitl, NPR News, Washington.
The Federal Reserve on Wednesday lowered its benchmark interest rate for the second time in 6 weeks. As that decision filters through the economy, it should get a little bit cheaper to borrow money to buy a car, grow a business, or just carry a balance on a credit card. The head of the central bank hinted that may be the last cut this year. Here's NPR's Scott Horsley.
By cutting its benchmark interest rate by a quarter percentage point, the Federal Reserve is trying to cushion the slowdown in the U.S. job market. Hiring has dropped sharply in recent months, and some big employers have announced widespread layoffs. While the unemployment rate, at last count, was still relatively low, Fed Chairman Jerome Powell and his colleagues want to prevent the job market from weakening any further.
A stronger labor market is the best thing we can do for the public. It's also part of our job, along with keeping prices stable.
For much of the year, the central bank kept interest rates relatively high in an effort to curb stubborn inflation. Prices are still climbing faster than the Fed would like, but not nearly as fast as they were a few years ago. Powell acknowledged many shoppers still bristle at the cumulative price hikes since the pandemic.
It's nice that, you know, that prices are not going up as fast as they were, but they're still much higher than they were. And it'll take some time for that effect to wear off.
President Trump's tariffs are also putting upward pressure on prices, although Powell and some of his colleagues think tariffs' inflationary impact will be limited. Getting a good read on the economy is particularly challenging right now, since much of the government data the Fed would ordinarily rely on has been suspended by the federal shutdown. And there's a wide range of views on the Fed's rate-setting committee. One member of the committee voted for a bigger half-point interest rate cut yesterday, while another voted not to cut rates at all. Powell says that disagreement is likely to resurface at the next Fed policy meeting in December.
In the committee's discussions at this meeting, there were strongly differing views about how to proceed in December. A further reduction in the policy rate at the December meeting is not a foregone conclusion. Far from it.
That was disappointing to investors who had been fairly confident that the central bank would cut its benchmark rate by another quarter percentage point before the end of this year. Market odds of a December rate cut fell after Powell's news conference yesterday, and so did the Dow Jones Industrial Average. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
This is NPR News.
And this is Morning Edition on the perfect mix of BBC, NPR, and KJZZ News. It is Thursday, October 30th, 2025. I'm Phil Latzman. Good morning. And ahead, President Trump recently signed several rare earth agreements with Asian countries to reduce America's reliance on China. Thin on details, the deals are unlikely to dent China's dominance, though. We'll have more on that in about 15 minutes here on KJZZ's Morning Edition.
KJZZ thanks business member Roastery of Cave Creek for their generous support of public radio and the local business community. One cup at a time. More at roc2.coffee.
We do have our big event, the First Press Fine Wine Festival, Saturday, February 21st at the Musical Instrument Museum. It's an afternoon of fine wines and appetizers and live music benefiting public radio. And early bird pricing ends on November 15th. So reserve your spot today. Go to fpraz.org. We're looking at another 90-degree day here in the Phoenix area, about 6 degrees above average. Right now it's 66 at 6:30.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. President Trump says his meeting with China's President Xi Jinping went extremely well. The two spoke for more than an hour and a half today at a South Korean military base on the sidelines of a regional economic summit. As NPR's Deepa Shivaram reports, Trump says China has agreed to do more to help stop the flow of fentanyl into the U.S. and to resume regular purchases of American soybeans.
Trump says he and Xi came to an agreement on a trade deal, but it hasn't been finalized just yet.
It was an outstanding group of decisions, I think, that was made. A lot of decisions were made, too. There wasn't too much left out there.
The U.S. will lower tariffs on China from 57 to 47% because of Xi's commitment to reduce the flow of fentanyl, Trump says. China will also start repurchasing soybeans from the U.S. and stop the recent limit on rare earths exports that was announced a few weeks ago. Trump says he will visit China next April and Xi will come to the U.S. after that. Deepa Shivaram, NPR News, Gyeongju, Korea.
Hurricane Melissa is expected to be near or over Bermuda by tonight. The storm is blamed for more than two dozen deaths in the Caribbean, mainly in Jamaica, Haiti, and the Dominican Republic. It remains a Category 2 storm. This is NPR News from Washington.
A check of KJZZ News in Phoenix at 6:30. Two dozens of Flagstaff residents weighed in on the city's contract with Flock Safety, a rapidly expanding company whose cameras are now operating in communities across the country. From KJZZ's Frontera's desk in Flagstaff, Michel Morisco reports on the recent city council meeting there where the debate unfolded Tuesday night after residents filed a petition to end the program.
Some of those who spoke against the cameras were supportive of Flagstaff police, but not Flock. Flagstaff resident Alyssa Hughes.
How can we trust these AI cameras when they are put up without the consent of the people? How can we trust that our information is safe?
Flock cameras and license plate readers recorded nearly a half million vehicles here in the last 30 days. Problems persist nationally. Police share data with Homeland Security, sometimes illegally. A Kansas officer used the cameras to track his ex-girlfriend, and police in Texas tracked a woman who had a self-administered abortion. Sedona ended its Flock contract after a backlash. The Navajo Nation government supports the program. Coconino County Attorney Ammon Barker supported the cameras but said there is an opportunity for oversight.
I believe this community is sophisticated enough to grapple with the tension between privacy and security without giving up either one completely.
The city is putting together a citizens task force to review its agreement. It's reducing the number of days it keeps data from 30 to 14. Police will only share data with area law enforcement. Councilwoman Miranda Sweet warned the city needs a policy.
Technology is here. We will be needing these policies in place.
Michel Marisco, KJZZ News, Flagstaff.
Peter Sagal here. Wait, Wait is finally coming back to Phoenix at the Arizona Financial Theater on December 4th. KJZZ members will get a chance to buy tickets early, so check your email for an exclusive presale offer just for members.
Traffic. One thing to note, if you're listening in the Sunflower area, State Route 87 closed near Sunflower due to a crash at milepost 221. A high today of 90 degrees. We are now at 64 in Phoenix at 634.
Good morning, I'm Leila Faldin. High schoolers in Queensland, Australia came in this week prepared for an exam on the Roman Emperor Augustus. But there was a problem. Their ancient history exam was actually about Augustus's great uncle, Julius Caesar. The change in the curriculum from Augustus to Caesar was made this year, but there was a miscommunication between their schools and state regulators. Officials promised students won't be penalized for the mix-up, even if they do all fail Caesar. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on Thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. From The Economist, in a world of rapid change, The Economist seeks to cut through the noise to offer insight into what matters now and what's coming next. Daily global reporting, podcasts, videos, and more at economist.com. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez in Culver City, California.
And I'm Leila Faldin in Washington, D.C. President Trump deployed the National Guard to Los Angeles 4 months ago in June. He mobilized the Guard here in D.C. in August. Then he sent the Guard to Oregon, Illinois, and Tennessee. And just this week, President Trump said, quote, if we need more than the National Guard, we'll send more than the National Guard because we're going to have safe cities. And using the Guard this way is something the president's inner circle and at times Trump himself have talked explicitly about for years, most notably to help with planned immigration raids and mass deportations. NPR's Kat Lonsdorf has been looking into this and she joins me now. Good morning, Kat.
Good morning.
So what has the president said about this?
Well, one of the big ideas Trump ran on leading up to his reelection was his plan to carry out the largest deportation operation in American history.
Yeah.
And he would need personnel for that. In a Time magazine interview before the election last year, Trump specifically said he would use the National Guard to help. That's an idea that Stephen Miller, now Trump's right-hand man on immigration, has been talking about for a while. Back in 2023, he appeared on the late Charlie Kirk's right-wing podcast to talk about how mass deportations in Trump's second term would work.
Then in terms of personnel, you go to the red state governors and you say, give us your National Guard. We will deputize them as immigration enforcement officers.
He went on to describe that for Democratic states that don't comply, they would send the Guard in from red states. That's something that we've seen start to play out in places like Illinois.
Yeah, so we've been seeing that. But National Guard troops, I mean, broadly, we're not seeing them make arrests or carry out warrants.
Right.
What do we know about how troops are actually being used?
Yeah, those plans that Trump and Miller outlined before Trump took office aren't legal under normal U.S. law. The Posse Comitatus Act bars federal troops from participating in civilian law enforcement. Here in D.C., you know, we've mainly seen Guard members picking up trash or strolling around neighborhoods.
Yeah.
In cases like Chicago, though, the Trump administration says that they are being deployed to protect federal immigration facilities and officers. But, you know, where's the line there? Can troops protect an ICE agent while that agent carries out an arrest, for example? These are some of the questions that courts are trying to answer amid the legal challenges over these deployments.
You know, Trump has talked about the Insurrection Act. What has he said about invoking it in order to be able to deputize the military as law enforcement?
Yeah, he's been talking about it a lot. Earlier this month, he said that he was, quote, allowed to invoke the Insurrection Act if the courts deny his deployments. We're waiting to see how courts rule for both Portland and Chicago, where prosecutors and federal judges have questioned the need for troops on the ground. Trump invoking the Insurrection Act to allow troops to help with immigration enforcement is also something that Stephen Miller has talked about. He told the New York Times back in 2023 that, quote, President Trump will do whatever it takes.
What are immigration advocates and legal experts saying about this?
I mean, many experts I've talked to are worried as they're watching this and thinking through how it could play out. I talked to Kiko Matos. She's the president of the National Immigration Law Center. It's an immigrant advocacy organization. She told me that they've been tracking all of this since before the election, trying to prepare. She says they see it as not only a threat to immigrants, but to democracy as well.
What I have said repeatedly is that the path to authoritarianism in this country is being built on the backs of immigrants. They will begin with immigrants. They will not end with immigrants.
Matos says it has her worried about the upcoming 2026 midterm elections and what the presence of troops might mean for those. That's a very common concern from pretty much every legal expert I've talked to. What armed troops on the streets could mean as voters cast ballots next year.
That's NPR's Kat Lonsdorf. Thank you, Kat.
Thank you.
The average new car in the United States costs $50,000, according to Kelley Blue Book. NPR has been exploring how people are coping with inflation in our series, Cost of Living, the Price We Pay. Now, today, NPR's Camila Domonoske takes a look at the price we all pay for cars, both the obvious and overlooked.
When you buy a car, you're also signing up to pay for car insurance, maintenance, gasoline. And since 2020, all those costs have soared one after another.
Every year, something seems to go berserk.
Heather Long is the chief economist at Navy Federal Credit Union. She's been tracking these costs. Gasoline is actually cheap at the moment, but even so, the total cost of car ownership has outstripped inflation.
I kept waiting for when are things going to level off, and there's been really no relief for car ownership costs.
And then there's the hidden cost of cars, paid by drivers and by society. Sarah Goodyear is the co-host of the cheekily named War on Cars podcast and the co-author of the new book Life After Cars, which tallies the many different costs.
You have your healthcare costs, which you might not realize are car related.
Tailpipe pollution and car noise hurt our health, but how do you tally how much that costs? Well, Goodyear cites a Japanese study of a town that got a train station, suddenly reducing their reliance on cars.
And the change was really dramatic. Their healthcare costs went down by an average of $600 per year.
Other invisible costs include the tax dollars that fund roads, the cost of parking lots,
the cost of the time that we spend in cars.
And the list goes on. But so much of America is designed around cars that it's hard to live without them, except in a few places. Pricey places.
A walkable, bikeable, transit-rich neighborhood like the one I live in Brooklyn, New York, is a luxury good. It is not affordable for the vast number of Americans.
Goodyear's new book argues that American cities and towns can become less car-centric, especially as more Americans realize how much cars actually cost us all. But for now, cars are essential in most places. So as costs rise, families are keeping old cars longer or taking on more debt to buy a vehicle. Or they're sharing, like Claudia Pineda, who lives in El Paso, where public transit is limited. Pineda lives with three grown kids, as well as one teenager. One of her 20-somethings has her own car, but the others rely on Pineda and her mom car to get to and from work.
I feel like an Uber driver who is very underpaid right now.
She would love to get another vehicle to share, but it's just too expensive. So they make do. But Pineda is determined to find a silver lining in all the time they spend together in the car.
Even listening to music, listening to the things my kids listen to, and keeping an open mind, hearing them hum some of these oldies that I listen to because they're learning them.
Her Gen Z daughter knows all the words to End of the Road. Boys to Men, 1992. That makes Pineda smile. And that's worth something while they save up for another vehicle. Camila Domonoske, NPR News.
Girl, I'm here for you. All those times at night when you just heard me and just ran out with that other fella. Baby, I knew about it. I just didn't care.
This is NPR News.
All right, from Boys to Men. Here it's Morning Edition on KJZZ on this Thursday morning. Ahead, negotiations between Pakistan and Afghanistan broke down yesterday after both sides failed to resolve tensions that sparked violent clashes earlier this month. We'll have the latest on that situation coming up in about 10 minutes on KJZZ's Morning Edition.
Support for Marketplace on KJZZ comes from Carlisle Companies, a Phoenix-based building products company committed to making innovative building materials for more energy-efficient residential homes and commercial buildings. More at Carlisle.com.
A check of KJZZ News now at 6:43. Updating traffic. It looks like State Route 87 southbound in the Sunflower area is now closed at State Route 188 at the junction there. So if you're headed south from the Payson area or in that area, be wary of that. Arizona State Senator Jake Hoffman has a new bone to pick with Gina Swoboda, the location for a meeting in January to elect Swoboda's successor as chair of the state Republican Party. From KJZZ's politics desk, Cameron Sanchez reports.
Republican Party members meet in January every other year to elect party leaders. In 2026, that meeting will be held in Prescott Valley. It's the first time the biannual meeting will be hosted outside Maricopa County in years. Hoffman claims Swoboda chose the location as a scheme to suppress the turnout of GOP committeemen in Maricopa County, by far the state's most populous county. Part of an effort, Hoffman says, by Swoboda to help her elect her, quote, favored candidate as chairman. But Swoboda, who's running for Congress rather than re-election as state party chair, says she has no preferred candidate. And rural GOP county leaders issued a statement in support of efforts to, for once, hold a meeting in their part of the state. Cameron Sanchez, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
When you donate your mechanically sound car, truck, boat, golf cart, or RV to KJZZ, we sell it without the middleman. That's what we did with a Nissan Murano donated by Marissa in Phoenix, who's now a member. Learn more at cars.kjzz.org.
We're still going to stay a few degrees above normal for late October. Temps in the 90-degree range the next few days. 90 is actually the forecast high in Phoenix after getting to 91 yesterday, which was about 7 degrees above average. And we'll be at the 90 range, looks like, through the weekend, maybe in early next week, right around that, for highs here in the valley. Right now in Phoenix, 64 degrees at 6:45.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from BritBox, committed to helping viewers to see it differently with British TV. With new original series like Code of Silence, about a deaf woman recruited as a lip reader in a high-stakes police investigation. Streaming at BritBox.com. From CFP, Certified Financial Planner Professionals, committed to acting in their clients' best interests. Learn more at letsmakeaplan.org. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Leila Faldin. Good morning. During his trip through Asia this week, President Trump signed agreements about rare earths with several nations. It's part of an effort to reduce U.S. reliance on China for the elements, which are critical to make everything from electric vehicles to jet fighters. The agreements are short on detail and with a long timeline. NPR's international affairs correspondent Jackie Northam reports.
President Trump has made building up the country's self-sufficiency in rare earths an important part of his administration. This week, he went into the region China dominates, signing rare earth agreements with Japan, Malaysia, Thailand, Vietnam, and Cambodia.
I think they're very strategically placed deals.
Ryan Castillo is the managing director and founder of Atomos Intelligence, which focuses on rare earths and battery materials. He says the timing of Trump's rare earth deals was notable, just ahead of his meeting with Chinese President Xi Jinping.
I think it's very much a challenge to China and is designed to help strengthen the U.S.'s hand in advance of Trump-Xi meetings this week.
The rare earth deals vary by country, depending on what they need from the U.S. and what they have to offer. Castillo says, for example, Thailand is a hub for processing rare earth minerals. Malaysia has an abundance of rare earths, but could use U.S. investment to build infrastructure. Castillo says Japan is a major producer of rare earth permanent magnets, but relies on Chinese suppliers.
So partnering with Japan to try and help it cross the final chasm of reliance on China dovetails with the U.S.'s own interests that can help undermine or erode China's dominance longer term.
Still, it's unlikely the new agreements will be enough to break China's dominance on rare earths.
It's just a lot of noise. All of that activity is to give the appearance of progress. But the truth is, all of those things are just headline-seeking, headline-grabbing.
James Kennedy is the founder of 3 Consulting, which specializes in rare earth minerals. He says many of the Asian nations already supply rare earths to China and may be leery of angering their powerful neighbor by working with the U.S. Kennedy points to Vietnam, which he says is under the shadow of China.
If the U.S. goes in and tries to cut deals in Vietnam, they're probably going to get a backlash from China because China considers that part of their Monroe Doctrine.
In other words, China does not want to see U.S. influence in its backyard. But even if the Asian nations do follow through with U.S. agreements, nothing is going to happen overnight, says Ted Wittenstein, a specialist on U.S., China, and technology security issues at Yale University.
The process of rare earth extraction all the way to refining, all the way to manufacturing actual products, it is a very complex supply chain, and it's very difficult to construct. The challenge is going to be the timeline.
Not to mention money. Wittenstein says it's still worth doing the agreements, even if the impact on China's rare earth dominance is limited.
It can certainly have the effect of signaling to Beijing that the United States will continue to look to diversify, if not secure, its own supply chain.
Wittenstein says the U.S. will have to create more alliances and agreements in other parts of the world to be fully self-sufficient in rare earths. Jackie Northam, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
And this is Morning Edition on KJZZ. Ahead, open enrollment for 2026 insurance plans sold on the Affordable Care Act marketplace starts Saturday. If Congress does not extend the subsidies, the average monthly premium is expected to double for many. We'll hear more about that to begin the next hour of Morning Edition here on 91.5.
Support for KJZZ's car donation program comes from local Kia dealers, offering the Sportage Hybrid, an SUV with a turbocharged hybrid engine producing 232 horsepower. More info at Kia.com.
A check of international news now, 10 minutes to 7. French prosecutors say 5 new suspects have been arrested in connection with the audacious daylight heist at the world-famous Louvre Museum in Paris. The BBC's Andrew Harding has more from Paris.
French investigators are saying that the five new suspects were arrested simultaneously last night at various locations in the Paris region. They can now be detained for 4 days before being charged or released. Yesterday evening, a French prosecutor mentioned the possibility that detectives were looking not just for the remaining two thieves seen by the famous ladder they used to get into the Louvre, but for members of what could be a larger gang. The thieves did leave significant DNA evidence around the crime scene, but the jewels themselves have yet to be found.
That's the BBC's Andrew Harding in Paris.
There's ongoing concern about the mental health of American kids and adolescents. This morning at 9 on the show, are universal mental health screenings in school the answer? And we'll meet Arizona's 2026 Teacher of the Year. That and more on the show this morning at 9 on KJZZ and KJZZ.org.
If you got a minute, 60 seconds is all it takes to play KJZZ's new Minute Mix. Visit play.kjzz.org to check it out. Traffic still up in the area near Sunflower State. Route 87 remains closed. That is due to an accident there, and it's closed at the State Route 188. A high of 90 degrees today in Phoenix is the forecast high. Right now we're at 64 at 6:52.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm Amy Martinez. Peace talks between Pakistan and Afghanistan collapsed on Wednesday. That's after armies from the two countries shot at each other earlier this month. Betsy Joles has more from Islamabad.
The failure of peace talks in Istanbul is dominating the news cycle here.
پاکستان نے افغان طالبان کی جانب سے پاکستان مخالف دہشت گردوں کی مسلسل حمایت پر پاکستان کی کوششیں
The talks were meant to iron out a lasting truce that would calm tensions along the Pakistan-Afghanistan border. But after 4 days of negotiations, Pakistani officials announced that they'd failed to find a solution. In a post on X, Pakistan's information minister, Atullah Tarar, said that's because the Afghan Taliban government didn't assure Pakistan that it would act against militant groups that target it. These are groups like the TTP that Pakistan says operate from bases inside Afghanistan. The TTP, known as the Pakistani Taliban, frequently carries out attacks in Pakistan with the goal of setting up hardline rule. President Trump said a few days ago that the conflict would be an easy fix.
I heard that Pakistan and Afghanistan have started up, but I'll get that solved very quickly.
But it's complicated. The Afghan Taliban government denies supporting the TTP and other militant groups. Experts note that attacks from these groups have increased since the Taliban took control 4 years ago, after the United States withdrew its troops from Afghanistan. Abdul Basit from the Esrajaratnam School of International Studies in Singapore says the two sides publicly disagree about where the attacks emanate from.
Taliban say it is from within Pakistan. Pakistani position it is either cross-border.
Tensions heated up earlier this month after a militant attack killed 11 Pakistani soldiers near the border. This was followed by a series of strikes inside Afghanistan and cross-border firing between Afghan and Pakistani forces. Both sides agreed to a ceasefire on October 19th, after an initial round of talks in Qatar. That ceasefire has officially held, but many worry the region could become more volatile now. For NPR News, I'm Betsy Joles in Islamabad.
Next, we have one doctor's experience of Gaza. In about a minute, you'll hear a graphic account of what he witnessed. Mihir Chowdhury is an American trauma surgeon who practices at Grady Memorial Hospital in Atlanta. He recently volunteered at one of Gaza's last functioning medical facilities, Nasser Hospital. His five-week stay was marked by intense violence, then the start of the ceasefire, when Israel released nearly 2,000 Palestinian prisoners and detainees in exchange for hostages.
I was there during a very particular arc of the genocide, I think, and got to experience a range of emotions with Palestinians in Gaza.
And you call it a genocide. I know that's something Israel and the U.S. deny, but it's something international human rights groups, top genocide scholars say is happening in Gaza. Why do you call it that?
Yeah, I'll be honest with you, Leila. I think it was clear that every life-affirming structure that existed prior to Israel's attacks in Gaza had been either completely destroyed or rendered unfunctional.
Dr. Chowdhury saw the results of that destruction in the lives and bodies of his patients. He shared detailed allegations with us of violence, starvation, and torture.
Every age, men, women, elderly, children were being attacked in very grotesque ways. You know, I saw many, many children who were shot through the head, shot through the abdomen, the chest. It was very clear to me what was being done by the Israeli military in Gaza.
Now, you examined patients on your last day who had been held by Israel and were returned to Gaza as part of this ceasefire deal. What did you see when you examined them?
Every single Palestinian captive that I saw around 40 of them total. Every single one had signs of very advanced malnutrition, even more advanced malnutrition than some of the patients I'd been seeing in Gaza, actually. Completely wasted away. There's very little muscle mass left, very little strength even in being able to walk over to the examining table. Each one had scabies infection, which is like a skin infection that occurs in very overcrowded jail and prison environments. Mm-hmm. They reported to me that they were forced to drink toilet water. They were given kind of the minimum amount of food to survive, maybe around one meal a day. And as they got closer to their release, they reported increasing levels of physical attacks and abuse.
Did you see signs of that on their bodies?
I did, actually, yeah. And examining them, I felt like rib cages that were chronically deformed from fractures. I saw one young Palestinian whose right arm was completely deformed from an attack and an intentional breaking of his arm. I saw areas where patients had had prior surgeries or wounds that they reported were intentionally targeted for attack to maximize kind of suffering and pain.
They're saying the prison guards were doing this to them?
The prison guards were doing this, yes, yes. Two patients had fresh wounds that they told me were from gunshots that were done to them by the Israeli guards that were not treated, that were kind of in a state of chronic infection from poor treatment.
And what else did they say about their treatment?
A common story was that their wrists would be bound and they would be forced to crouch naked in groups for very extended periods of time. Many of them reported chronic back pain and musculoskeletal issues after those things were done to them. Hmm.
Does any one patient in particular stick with you from your time in Gaza?
Yes, actually. I remember one older Palestinian man. He reported to me that he had been held also without charge, you know, in Israeli prison for over 2 years, and that he experienced frequent beatings. But he had this kind of faith or belief that no matter what Gaza will go through at the hands of Israel, that there will still be liberation and justice. One thing which I feel like was definitely true of my experience in Gaza was an incredible strength that emanates from the spirituality and faith of the people in Gaza. And I definitely felt it in that man's story.
Dr. Mihir Chaudhry, a trauma surgeon who is back from Gaza after treating patients at Nasser Hospital with the nonprofit Galia. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much, Leila.
We reached out to the Israeli military with what Dr. Chaudhry said he witnessed as he examined the released detainees. The military said that any abuse of detainees violates the law and is strictly prohibited, that detainees get regular medical exams, appropriate care, three meals a day, and constant access to water, and, quote, detainees are not forced to remain in a crouching position. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm A. Martinez.
And I'm Phil Latzman, and happy Thursday. This is member-supported KJZZ, FM Phoenix, and HD. We also broadcast on K221 EK Glenwood Silver City on 92.1 FM and on K295 AL Little Acres and Globe at 106.9 FM.
KJZZ is supported by Albertsons and Safeway Pharmacies with over 15 vaccines available like flu, COVID-19, shingles, pneumonia, hepatitis B, and travel vaccines. Appointments on the grocery app or visit albertsonsorsafeway.com/vaccinations.
Couple of traffic notes for you. Crash blocks a left lane. Looks like I-10 eastbound. That's near 7th Avenue right near the Deck Park Tunnel. Also on State Route 87 in the Sunflower area, the road is closed there due to a crash.
Prenatalists say the lower birth rate means women must have more babies, but a sociologist says there's something more going on. The pronatalist movement, next time, Here and Now.
Join us for Here and Now this morning at 10. after the show. Listen more, learn more here on 91.5. And 91 yesterday, and that was about 7 degrees above normal. Expecting 90 today, which keeps us several degrees above. Right now, it's 64 in Phoenix, 7 o'clock.
Good morning. This weekend, people getting health insurance through federal marketplaces will see their average monthly prices go up a lot. Will they get sticker shock and decide to skip insurance altogether? It's Morning Edition from NPR News.
And in KJZZ News, Adelita Grijalva begins her 37th day of waiting to be sworn into Congress since her special election win. That's the most this century.
The federal shutdown is threatening access to child care and schooling for 65,000 infants and preschoolers. I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm Amy Martinez. Without federal funding, many Head Start centers will have to close next month. Also, a planned Senate hearing for President Trump's pick for Surgeon General gets delayed after she goes into labor. And California farmers say the Republican congressman understands them, and they don't want a Democratic redistricting plan that could change that. It's Thursday, October 30th. On this day in 1974, Muhammad Ali knocked out George Foreman in the Rumble in the Jungle. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. New proposals by the Department of Health and Human Services will dramatically restrict gender-affirming care for transgender youth. As NPR's Selena Simmons-Duffin exclusively reports, these rules are being prepared for release in early November.
The two proposed rules use Medicaid to try to force hospitals and doctors not to provide gender-affirming care for young people. One of the rules prohibits them from getting reimbursed for patients receiving this care who are covered by Medicaid. NPR obtained the draft text of this rule. The other rule is even more sweeping. It would make not providing gender-affirming care for youth a condition for a hospital to get Medicare and Medicaid payments at all. The new rules would not go into effect immediately, but there has already been a chilling effect on access to the care. Gender-affirming care, including puberty blockers, hormones, and rarely surgery, is not against any federal law, but it has been banned in 27 states in recent years. Selena Simmons-Duffin, NPR News, Washington.
Stocks opened mixed this morning after President Trump's much-hyped meeting with Chinese President Xi Jinping. NPR Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose about 180 points in early trading.
This was President Trump's first face-to-face meeting with his Chinese counterpart since returning to office, and it seems to have produced at least a partial thaw in trade tensions between the world's two biggest economies. Trump says China's agreed to end its boycott of U.S. soybeans and ease export restrictions on rare earth minerals. For his part, Trump's lowering the tariff on imports from China, although Chinese goods will still be taxed at an average rate of nearly 50%. Stocks were lower overnight in both Shanghai and Hong Kong. Stocks rose slightly in Tokyo as the Bank of Japan held interest rates steady. Here in the U.S., the Federal Reserve lowered its benchmark interest rate by a quarter point, but raised doubts about an additional cut at the next Fed meeting in December. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth says the U.S. military has destroyed another boat in the Eastern Pacific. He says four people were killed in the latest attack, as NPR's Quill Lawrence reports.
Hegseth posted a video on social media showing a small motorboat exploding. He said the boat, like more than a dozen others destroyed in recent weeks, was smuggling narcotics toward the United States. The Trump administration has labeled drug cartels terrorists and claims that makes it legal for the U.S. military to destroy the boats and kill the people on board, even if they're unarmed. Critics in Congress from both parties say this is execution without trial and goes against the U.S. Code of Military Justice. Senate Democrats have demanded that the Department of Justice make public any rulings it has issued that allow summarily killing criminal suspects. Quill Lawrence, NPR News.
On Wall Street, the Dow's up 170 points. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the estate of Joan B. Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio and seeks to help NPR be the model for high-quality journalism in the 21st century. This is NPR.
From KJZZ News in Phoenix, good morning. I'm Phil Latzman. Adelita Grijalva begins her 37th day of waiting to be sworn into Congress since her special election win. From KJZZ's politics desk, Wayne Shetsky reports that's longer than any other representative elect in the 21st century.
Grijalva won the election to replace her late father, Raul Grijalva, on September 23rd. But House Speaker Mike Johnson has so far refused to swear her in, saying he will do so when he calls the House back into session after the end of the government shutdown. According to data compiled by Bloomberg reporter Greg Giroux, Grijalva has waited longer than any other special election winner since 2001, surpassing California's Jimmy Gonzalez, who was sworn in 35 days after his election win in 2017. The only exception is former Oklahoma Representative John Sullivan, who was sworn in 50 days after he won a special election in 2002. But that's because an Oklahoma law allowed the election to take place a month before the seat was actually vacated. Wayne Chetsky, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Immigration authorities say a Honduran man is hospitalized in stable condition after being wounded while trying to flee a traffic stop with ICE officers yesterday in North Phoenix. As KJZZ's Matthew Casey reports, the incident led to snarled traffic on Interstate 17.
U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement says at around 4 a.m. near I-17 and Dove Valley Road, officers pulled over a Honduran man without authorization to be in the country. Authorities say Jose Garcia Sorto stopped at first, but then pulled away as ICE officers approached. An officer who was reportedly in Garcia's path fired their gun twice and hit Garcia's vehicle. The officer was taken to a hospital for evaluation. Garcia is being treated for an unidentified wound. The incident follows reports of a leadership change at the local ICE field office. Matthew Casey, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
A measles outbreak in northern Arizona is just shy of 100 cases, and recent trends show no sign of slowing down, with nearly 40 cases added this month. KJZZ's Greg Hawney has the latest on that.
The disease has also spread in southern Utah, where 45 cases have been recorded this year, making the total between the two states over 150 cases. That's more than a tenth of all cases nationwide, according to the latest numbers from the CDC, which missed a pivotal infectious disease meeting this month due to the ongoing government shutdown. Measles vaccination rates in Mojave County, the hardest hit in Arizona, were at 78% last school year for kindergartners. That's about 20 percentage points lower than what health officials recommend for community protection. Greg Hawney, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Sports, that's four straight losses for the Suns. They fall at home to the Grizzlies last night, 114-113. John Morant had 28 for Memphis, including the go-ahead shot with 7 seconds left. Suns were able to come back from 10 down midway through the fourth quarter. He'd gone ahead in the final minute. Devin Booker with 16 of his 32 in the final period, but missed a potential game-winning three at the buzzer. Phoenix has dropped four in a row since an opening night win. Traffic looks like they've reopened State Route 87 southbound in the Sunflower area, and looks like the crash I-10 eastbound near 7th Avenue is now on the left shoulder near the Deck Park Tunnel. A high of 90 today in Phoenix at 66 at 7:08.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
I'm Layla Faldin.
And I'm A. Martinez. Millions of Americans will be able to start shopping for health insurance on Saturday, and some of them might not like what they'll see. The average monthly premium for the roughly 24 million people who get their coverage through the Affordable Care Act marketplaces are expected to more than double. That's unless Congress extends subsidies that have been helping people pay for coverage. They were created in 2021 during the pandemic and eventually extended through this year. Democrats are hoping that people seeing much higher rates and then being vocal about them will convince Republicans to extend the subsidies quickly. Now, that standoff is what's behind the current government shutdown. Coming up, we'll talk to one of the architects of the Affordable Care Act about why the law was passed in the first place and what issues he sees with the ACA that still need to be fixed. But we'll start with the changes this weekend. Sarah Bowden is a health reporter in Pittsburgh. She's been following this. So, Sarah, the predictions are that the average premium is going to more than double. Do we know who might be hit the hardest?
So it really depends on where you live and how much you earn. For people who earn more than 400% of the federal poverty level, they're likely to see the biggest jumps. For example, let's say you and your spouse, you're both 60 years old and bring in a combined $85,000 a year, which is just over that 400% threshold. That means their subsidies will disappear in 2026 if nothing changes. This past year, a couple like that paid $600 a month for mid-level coverage, which is like known as a silver plan. Without the subsidies, that price tag shoots way up. Health policy think tank KFF did an analysis. It shows that if that couple lives in Pittsburgh, their premium will increase to more than $2,000 a month starting next year.
Okay, sounds like pretty big jumps. Is that going to be the way it's going to be everywhere? It's going to be high everywhere.
In some places, it's going to be even higher. Health insurance rates vary by location, and these subsidies won't be there to help. For example, if that same couple lives in Wheeling, West Virginia, which is just an hour from Pittsburgh, KFF estimates that a silver plan will cost them $4,200 come January.
A month?
Yes, a month. And rates are going to go up for people who have lower incomes as well. These subsidies also help them. Now, their price increases might not be as extreme, but they'll feel it in their wallets.
Do you think people will pay this much to get healthcare coverage?
A lot of Americans are still waiting to see their final rates. I spoke with Devin Trolley. She's the head of the insurance marketplace here in Pennsylvania, and she's worried that people won't renew their coverage.
With these higher prices, what we'll really be looking at is how many of our current enrollees are making the difficult decision to drop coverage, and are we getting any new enrollees in, or are they really pushed away by the cost as well?
So, Sarah, I mean, how long will we have to wait to see whether people are signing up?
Charlie says that in her experience, people who already have coverage for the marketplace tend to sign up at the start of open enrollment. These are folks who will be most aware of premium increases because they can compare their new 2026 rates to what they currently pay. So I'm guessing we'll hear pretty soon from folks if they're upset about the prices or have sticker shock. We're talking about real estate agents, manicurists, farmers. KFF found these people that they're going to be more likely to be self-employed and to rely on insurance from the marketplace. It's going to be interesting to see how members of Congress react, and I'll be watching to see if they change their positions on ACA subsidies and if this might break the stalemate in Congress and end the government shutdown.
All right, that's reporter Sarah Bowden in Pittsburgh. Thank you for talking through the subsidies with us.
My pleasure.
Democrats argue that without these subsidies, the cost to buy these policies is going to skyrocket. Republicans say the Affordable Care Act isn't doing anything about runaway health costs, but they insist they will talk about this once Democrats agree to support the Republican spending bill. But that invites the question of why so many people need a subsidy from the government to afford health insurance to begin with. And is this really the best way to get health care to people who didn't already have access to it? So we're calling somebody who was there at the creation. That's Dr. Ezekiel Emanuel. He is an oncologist, an authority on bioethics, and vice provost for global initiatives at the University of Pennsylvania Perelman School of Medicine. And he is considered one of the architects of the ACA. And he's with us now. Good morning, doctor. Thanks so much for joining us.
It's my great pleasure to be with you.
So a lot of people get health insurance through their employers. We've had Medicare, which helps pay for health care for seniors. We have Medicaid, which helps pay for health care for people with very low incomes. What was the problem the ACA was intended to solve?
Well, the problem was about 45 million uninsured Americans, many of them working at relatively low paying jobs where the employer could not afford to offer health insurance. Some of them disabled, some of them just out of the system or not understanding how to get health insurance because it was complicated. That constituted, when we passed the ACA, 18% of the population. The other aspect is that healthcare costs have been going up nearly 7% per year under the Bush administration from 2000 to 2009. And that rise in healthcare costs was putting a lot of pressure on families.
So let's talk about the first one. As you just mentioned, it was designed to increase access to health insurance coverage. It's largely done that. The uninsured rate has gone from about 15% in 2010 to about 8% in 2024. That's according to the most recent estimate that we have by the Centers for Disease Control. How did it accomplish that?
Well, one, many of your listeners will remember, we allowed young people to stay on their parents' insurance all the way up to age 26 while they were getting their first job. The second was we expanded Medicaid in conjunction with the states. We changed it from a program that only covered pregnant women or the disabled or the elderly who were poor to cover all poor people under 138% of the federal poverty line. And the third way is we established these exchanges for people who were working in middle-class jobs often who just couldn't get insurance for a variety of reasons. And we had an exchange where private insurers would offer policies that people could get. I would say there was a fourth thing, which is we got rid of the pre-existing disease exclusions.
Are there issues that you see now that you didn't see when you were first helping to craft the ACA? And is there anything that has emerged since then that you didn't anticipate?
Yes, I would say two major changes I would like to make in hindsight. One is the system's incredibly complicated. You can get insurance through Medicare. You can get insurance through Medicaid. You can get insurance through your employer. You can get insurance in the exchanges, in the VA, if you're a Native American, Indian Health Service, and on and on and on. That complication, frankly, the Affordable Care added to that complication by putting in the exchanges. The second, I think, big change that I would like to make is more standardization of the insurance products. We allowed these high deductible plans so that even people who have insurance are dissuaded from going to the doctor because they're worried about the cost. We have high copays so that, again, even if you're insured, you can actually be spending out-of-pocket expenses of thousands and thousands of dollars and go bankrupt. And by the way, there are some states that have really done that, like California in its exchange has really standardized the products that are offered. So it's a lot easier for people to compare products. And with more competition over the same kind of product, you should lower the costs.
Well, to that end, let's talk about the cost. The Congressional Budget Office estimates that these subsidies that we've been talking about, these tax credits, will cost about $350 billion over 10 years. And there are people like, I mean, for example, I'm saying Wisconsin Senator Ron Johnson, who was on this program a couple of weeks ago, said, we just can't afford it. It's just too expensive. What do you say to that?
We are spending 17.5% of our GDP. We have a completely inefficient healthcare system. We can afford it. We spend more by $1.5 trillion than any other country on healthcare. We could afford it. We have way too much administrative costs, $1 trillion. So I think there's a lot we could do to actually streamline the system, save money, and use it to cover people. But the idea that some people should risk dying because we don't have $350 billion over 10 years, and Ron Johnson is voting for tax cuts for billionaires, that just doesn't compute. That's not a consistent policy.
Why is this such an intractable problem?
That has to do with how we've structured the system. The fact that the system is this complicated, as I mentioned, increases administrative costs to $1 trillion. Another problem is the way we pay doctors and hospitals and other people providing care, mainly by fee for service. That obviously creates an incentive to do more, even when that more is not the most efficient way to do it or totally necessary. We have variable costs. You know, there's not a single price for a stay in the hospital. There's a Medicare price, there's a Medicaid price, and every insurance company has multiple prices with that exact same hospital for that exact same procedure or overnight stay or whatever. Talk about creating all sorts of gaming opportunities for people to make money even though they're not providing better care.
You once told my colleague Scott Simon, I think this was back in 2014, that while the Affordable Care Act isn't perfect, it's a, quote, pretty good structure to go forward, unquote. You still think so?
Yeah, it certainly accomplished a lot. It reduced the uninsured rate. It controlled costs. Now we need even more extensive reform to reform the health insurance system, to reform the delivery system and how we pay. Those things we couldn't get to without the Affordable Care Act being a step in the right direction, but it wasn't a finished product.
That is Dr. Ezekiel Emanuel. He's considered one of the architects of the Affordable Care Act. Dr. Emanuel, thanks so much for sharing these insights and recollections with us.
Well, this has been a wonderful interview, and I hope your audience has learned something about the benefits of the Affordable Care Act.
And tomorrow on Morning Edition, we'll take another look at the impact of the government shutdown as it nears a month. Around 42 million people across the U.S. stand to lose federal food aid benefits on Saturday when funding runs out. Some states are scrambling to fill in the gaps left if these benefits, known as SNAP, are paused. It's the first time the program, which dates back to the Great Depression, has been disrupted in this way. Listen on a smart speaker, in the NPR app, or on this public radio station. This is NPR News.
And this is Morning Edition on KJZZ 719. On this Thursday morning, good to have you along. Ahead, President Trump's nominee for Surgeon General will likely face tough questions about her qualifications and views on vaccines from senators during today's confirmation hearing. We'll have a preview of that ahead in about 15 minutes at 734 here on KJZZ's Morning Edition.
KJZZ is supported by Viet Greyhawk, a North Scottsdale retirement community offering new apartment finishes, remodeled community spaces, and a social neighborhood spirit. V is an equal housing opportunity community.
Now, check of KJZZ News at 7:20. Just a couple traffic updates, putting the period on an accident that was blocking lanes. In fact, had closed State Route 87 in the Sunflower area. Southbound, it's now reopened. Also, a vehicle had been blocking a right lane in the Deck Park Tunnel near at I-10 eastbound at 7th Avenue. That's clear as well. The city of Flagstaff is putting together a citizens task force to review its agreement with the license plate reader company expanding across the country. Flagstaff's contract with Flock Safety is under review amid suspicion from local residents about how that data is used. Flock camera data has been used to solve felonies and violent crime in Flagstaff, but nationally the cameras have also been used by police to illegally share data with federal immigration agents to stalk personal relationships and is considered a threat by rights groups like the ACLU. At Tuesday's city council meeting, Flagstaff's Mayor Becky Daggett said she trusts the police.
And at the same time, I have concerns about Flock's conduct and am wary of them and their past practices. They've earned the public's suspicion.
Flagstaff police will limit their data sharing to area law enforcement. Now, the National Weather Service is dry and tranquil conditions with temperatures remaining above normal for the next week or so. Highs topping out around 90 degrees today. Similar temperatures through the weekend with nighttime lows in the low to mid 60s. Right now in Phoenix, we're at 68 degrees at 7:21.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. RWJF is a national philanthropy working toward a future where health is no longer a privilege, but a right. Learn more at rwjf.org. From the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org. And from the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org. This is NPR.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Leila Faldin. Good morning. Most of Jamaica is without power and has limited phone service after the strongest hurricane to ever hit the island made landfall this week. At least 8 people have died there. NPR's Greg Allen reports people are eager to send aid from South Florida, home to the second largest Jamaican community in the U.S.
At a warehouse in Doral, a Miami suburb, volunteers have been working to pack boxes filled with food, water, and hygiene products that are being shipped to Jamaica by Global Empowerment Mission. Joe Bernal is one of the volunteers.
These necessity kits will usually feed a family of 4. They have all types of goodies, and hopefully these will be on an airplane heading towards Jamaica tomorrow morning.
Global Empowerment Mission has been active in the Caribbean and around the world since it was founded in response to the 2010 Haiti earthquake. The charity says it has more than a dozen tractor-trailer-sized containers loaded with aid already on their way to Jamaica. One volunteer packing and taping up boxes was Dana Levy. She was born and raised in Jamaica and says her family members in the Kingston area came through the storm okay. She says they were worried, though, about Melissa's winds, 185 miles per hour at landfall.
The most powerful one before this was Gilbert in 1988. So people are feeling it right now, but they're happy to see that we're here packing goods to send back to Jamaica.
Despite its nearly unprecedented strength, Melissa was a relatively small hurricane that focused its destructive power on the island's western side. Raj Miraj, another volunteer, says his family and friends in the east in Kingston were all fine and remarkably upbeat.
It's the island, so there's always, I would say, a more positive attitude that, okay, everything's going to be fine. Let's not worry too much. But when the forecasters were predicting the amount of rain, the amount of winds, put that together with a very fragile infrastructure, very, very difficult situation.
Suddenly, one volunteer rings a bell while others cheer. They just completed a pallet of 50 boxes. Not everyone was in the mood to celebrate. Adrian Long was worried about his relatives who live near where Hurricane Melissa made landfall.
I have a lot of family there. My mom was born and raised in Southfield, St. Elizabeth, west of Black River, where the eye hit. Haven't heard from anybody. No power. Everything is probably gone.
Long says he came to pack aid boxes to do what he could to, in his words, serve his people. Greg Allen, NPR News, Doral, Florida.